Some of you know, we, Carol and I, have been involved in foster care for the last 5.5 years or so. And that's been a really good experience for our family. It's also been trying at times, and we're going through a little bit of a trying time right now with little Ellie. One of the most trying times has been visitation. So when we have a foster kid in our home, often we have to take him or her in. If there's a family member that is pursuing reunification, we have to take the child in to have visitation with that family member. And it's supervised, and it's at the Job and Family Services building. And it's just not a great experience, because it's like it's a government building, and there's this, like, you know, it's just kind of a grimy, you know, the lighting's not great. It's not a very cozy place, I guess, to take a kid. We've always had little ones. And so it's not a very fun place. Well, the worst time ever is to take kids in for visitation at Christmas time. And so there have been a couple times, it's like the last day that the office there is open before Christmas. And because I think most of us, hopefully, have a lot of warm memories about Christmas, being with your family and doing all the things that you do at Christmas time together with family, to go in for these visits at Christmas time is just as depressing as can be. Because every family there is there because the family is broken up, either because of drugs or whatever other, you know, thing has gone on in their family to break up the family, and the kids have been taken away then. And so it's like they're trying to create this little Christmassy moment, but they're like, and they're, everybody wants to visit that day. So it's like people are stuck in corners and in the hallway, and it's just not warm and cozy like you'd want Christmas to be. It's just heartbreaking to go in there and see these broken families. And talk about disintegration in the family and breakdown in the family. We're going to read about a pretty dysfunctional family in our text for today. Kids, I want to ask you, there's going to be a picture on the screen here. Who knows what movie that is from? What? Yeah, Up. All right, good. Up. That's one of our favorites at our house. Does anybody remember the kid's name? Russell. I heard somebody say it. Russell. What's his group that he's part of? The Wilderness Explorers Club, right? And at the beginning, Russell is kind of obnoxious. Like, you know, he keeps knocking on the door, and he's kind of harassing old Mr. Frederickson there. But as the movie unfolds, they kind of, you know, develop this friendship, this bond, and that kind of thing. And you realize there's more to Russell than meets the eye. And you realize eventually that he doesn't have a great relationship with his dad. In fact, seems to be estranged from his dad. He talks about his dad like he's, you know, a hero. He's this great dad. He gave me this compass and GPS device, and my dad knows everything. Well, there's this line I'm going to read when he's talking to Mr. Frederickson about his dad. And they're, remember, going through the wilderness, and they've got Kevin the bird there with them. He says about camping, "My dad made it sound so easy. He's really good at camping and how to make fire from rocks and stuff. He used to come to all my sweat lodge meetings." That's the explorers group that he's part of. He says, "And afterwards we'd go get ice cream at Fenton's. I always get chocolate and he gets butter brickle. Then we'd sit on this one curb right outside, and I'll count all the blue cars and he counts all the red ones. And whoever gets the most wins. I like that curb." And he says, "That might sound boring, but I think the boring stuff is the stuff I remember the most." Oh, I can't believe I'm tearing up just reading a stinking movie quote. But you just hear the heartache, right, of a kid that just wants to be close to his dad. And he can't be, because his dad, you know, has got a different family now. What I want to say is that every family is dysfunctional. Every family is dysfunctional. It's easy to look at the families at Job and Family Services at Christmas time. It's easy to look at a guy like this, and you probably know some families in your life that you would say, they're just a dysfunctional family. What I want to say is that every family is dysfunctional to some degree. And I've through my work with teens and just in the church in general, I've encountered this. I think we've got wonderful families here, but there's pain here too. There's brokenness here. I've coached some volleyball and interacted with girls and families through that, and I help out with FCA, and those are Christian kids at FCA at the school, and there's some brokenness, there's some hurt there, some wounds from parents, there's some family disintegration everywhere you look, even here at Olathe. There's tension between husband and wife, breakdown between parents and teens. And so whether we're talking about alcoholic fathers or manipulative mothers or abusive uncles or passive-aggressive aunts, domineering husbands, nagging wives, sibling rivalries, the names that we were called by family members, the words that wound us, silent treatments and sarcastic remarks and bickering about silly things, lies and bitterness and name-calling and rejection and lack of trust and suspicion and coldness, it's everywhere. We know that God is triune. God, there's one God in three persons, and there's been this perfect harmony of relationship within the Godhead, among the Father, the Son, and the Spirit for eternity into the past. There's always been this relationship of harmony and love, and since we're made in God's image, we're made for that. We're made for relationships, and that's perhaps nowhere clearly more clearly seen than in the family relationships that we have, the marriages and then the relationships with our kids, the nuclear family. Those relationships are designed to be a reflection of the Godhead, a reflection of the relationship between the Father and the Son and the Spirit. And so with the onset of sin in humanity, there is now the breakdown not only of our relationship with God. We're separated from God because of our sin, but we're also separated from one another because of our sin, including within the family. And so sin wrecks everything. And so every family is dysfunctional. Not just the one you grew up in, but yours now. Not just the one I grew up in, but the one I grew up in now. So it's not really a question of which families are dysfunctional. It's to what degree are these families dysfunctional? To what degree is my family dysfunctional? And so I recognize that I contribute to the dysfunction in my family. Everybody that's part of our family contributes to the dysfunction. And I contribute in different ways. Sometimes it's through grouchiness. Sometimes it's through being temperamental. Sometimes it's from being distant and aloof. But I contribute, and you contribute to the dysfunction in your family. There's a temptation to say, well, it's other families that are dysfunctional, not mine. We have this wonderful put-together family. And we just consider things as normal. And it's like, no, actually, there's more dysfunction here than we realize. And I'll just ask you before we get into the passage, I'm going to give you some challenge about your family and your marriage today. And so I want to ask you just up front, and be honest in your heart about this. Do you want God to work in your family? Do you want God to work in your family? Do you want to surrender your family to Him? Are you willing for God to allow God to come and disrupt things if they need to be disrupted? Are you willing for God to meddle in your life, in the life of your family? Well, we're going to be in Genesis 31. And I referred to this last week as the Jerry Springer show of the ancient Near East. There's quite the drama unfolding. Remember last week we read about Jacob working 7 years hoping to marry the beautiful Rachel, but Laban deceived him, and Jacob ended up marrying Leah instead, the ugly older sister. And then Jacob had to work 7 more years to pay the bride price to marry Rachel. So now he's got 2 wives, 2 sisters. Imagine that. And it said that Jacob loved Rachel more. Jacob loved Rachel more because she was the prettier one. But that God loved Leah even when nobody else did. And he blessed her with children. And eventually then Rachel, who was barren, gave her servant to Jacob. And we're going to look at just a family tree up here. You can just see how kind of twisted and convoluted this gets. So Jacob first with his wife Leah had 4 children. We read about this last week: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And then because Rachel can't have children, she ends up giving her servant, her maidservant, Bilhah, and she has 2 children. Remember that the emphasis on children and childbearing in that culture was so profound. This was a source of disgrace for Rachel to not have children. So if I can provide children for the family somehow. So she gives her servant Bilhah. So now Jacob's got six kids with two different women. But it doesn't end up there. Leah continues in the competition. She has two more through her maidservant. So now Jacob's with a third woman, and Gad and Asher come from that relationship. And then Leah has a couple more, Issachar and Zebulun. And then these are the 12 tribes of Israel. These are the figureheads of the 12 tribes of Israel. So Rachel finally does, God blesses her with some children, finally Joseph and Benjamin. And that's not where it stops. So now Jacob's got 12 sons. With four different women. Not sure about the daughters. Dinah, we know, she'll come in later. Really tragic story here, just in a couple chapters with Dinah that happens. And go ahead to the next one. I want to just give you a little highlight. So you can imagine just the family dynamics of Jacob having four different women, sons with four different women, the kind of the clashing that would go on among the wives, and the clashing that would go on among the sons, and who's favorite, and that kind of thing. So it gets pretty twisted up. Just to highlight a couple of these sons, just to kind of give you an idea where things go from, you know, after Genesis. Remember, we said last week that Judah, Leah's son Judah, ends up being the child through whom the promise is passed. And so Judah is the next one in the messianic line. And so from the Judah's line comes later King David and King Solomon and all the kings of Judah down to Jesus. So Leah, whom nobody else loved, God loved her and provided this great opportunity for her to be the, you know, great, 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 great grandmother of Jesus. Okay, let's look at another one. Joseph then becomes also a key character in the rest of Genesis. So God blesses Leah in a particular way, but God blesses Rachel also. And so Joseph, you'll remember, most of the rest of Genesis is going to be taken up with the story of Joseph. Because Joseph, though being sold into slavery by his brothers, he later rescues them from famine in Egypt. Remember, he rises from like a lowly slave up through the palace and ends up being in charge and provides for the family then. When the famine comes to the land. So, okay, go ahead to the next one. Benjamin also is a descendant, or King Saul is one of descendants of the tribe of Benjamin. And then Levi has descendants, including Moses and Aaron and Miriam. And the priesthood comes from that, as the Levites are the priests. So, all right. If you read in chapter 30, I'm just going to summarize here a little bit, and then we're going to start in verse 1 of chapter 31. But just to summarize the end of chapter 30, remember Jacob had worked for 14 years to get Leah and Rachel. He worked six more years to build his flock and provide for his family, so a total of 20 years working for Laban. And you would think that Laban and Jacob would have like their family now, right? Because of the marriages, they are family. But there's no sign that Laban is gracious and wants to help out his daughters and help out his new son-in-law. And instead, he's milking Jacob for all. He's trying to squeeze just every ounce of out of Jacob, every ounce of slave labor he can out of Jacob. And so the issues don't go away, even as Laban has more and more grandsons. And so there's this description of this back and forth, this tug of war, I guess, between the flocks of Laban. Jacob is the one doing he's taking care of the flocks, but Laban is the owner, and they're both trying to cheat each other. They're both trying to deceive each other. And so they'll make an agreement. They'll kind of make an agreement about who's going to get what part of the flocks. And so Jacob, you'll get the spotted goats, and Laban's going to keep the plain colored ones, the solid colored ones. And then as Jacob's caring for the spotted ones, they end up doing better and reproducing more, and they're healthier. And so then Laban comes along and says, "Oh, let's change it. Then you get the solid colored ones, and I'll keep the spotted ones." And so there's this back and forth. Jacob's trying to cheat Laban, get the bigger flocks. And Laban's always changing the terms of their agreement. And so they're both trying to cheat each other. Jacob even uses some odd techniques, some superstitious techniques to try to increase his own flocks. And so it's all very deceptive. They're going back and forth in this, like I said, kind of a tug of war, trying to get the bigger flocks, trying to cheat each other out of the better part of the flock. But we know that behind the scenes, God is at work, okay? And so even though Jacob and Laban, their behavior here is really pretty despicable, that God is at work behind the scenes, and God has made a promise to Jacob. And so I'm going to just refer you back to that. Back in Genesis chapter 28, remember Jacob had that dream of the stairway. And so this is Genesis chapter 28, verses 13 to 15. If you just flip back a couple pages, it's not on the screen. But he says to Jacob in that he had said to Jacob in that episode with the dream previously, he said, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." So God's given Jacob this promise. The promise that he had made with to Abraham and to Isaac is now made also to Jacob, that he's going to have descendants. He's going to inherit this land. And so God is going to protect. God is going to work to keep his promise to Jacob. So even as Jacob and Laban are feuding over flocks and daughters and land and all this, God is behind the scenes and he's going to take care of Jacob. And it's by grace. Jacob doesn't deserve the treatment that he gets from God. He's going to be blessed, not because of his merit, but because of God's grace. At the end of Genesis 30, it says that Jacob had grown exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks. So Jacob benefits because God is blessing him. God's not confirming that Jacob's a good guy and everything he's doing is great, but God is blessing Jacob because of the promise he had made. Well, let's get into chapter 31 now in verse 1. Jacob heard that Laban's sons were saying, "Jacob has taken everything our father owned and has gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father." And Jacob noticed that Laban's attitude toward him was not what it had been. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." So this relationship between Jacob and Laban is just increasingly hostile and adversarial. Laban is frustrated as he realizes he can't, no matter how many times he changes the wages and changes the agreement, he can't get the best of Jacob. And so they're trying to out-scheme each other. Now the feud has spread to Laban's sons. And so the conflict just increases. Laban's sons would be jealous of Jacob, jealous of his wealth. And so here they say that he's taken it. And so there's this feud now between Jacob and Laban and his sons. And in the midst of that, in verse 3 there, we read that God speaks to Jacob and tells him to go back to Isaac, tells him to go back. Now, remember, that would be a little bit dangerous because of the way he's deceived Isaac and the way that, remember, Esau's rage at being duped. But now this is God's will for Jacob's life. And so in the past, remember that Jacob has not been a man of great faith, has not been an obedient son. He's been disrespectful. And so how will Jacob respond now? And God promises him, "I will be with you. I will be with you." Let's see how he responds. Verse 4. So Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah to come out to the fields where his flocks were. He said to them, "I see that your father's attitude toward me is not what it was before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I've worked for your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. If he said, 'The speckled ones will be your wages,' then all the flocks gave birth to speckled young. And if he said, 'The streaked ones will be your wages,' then all the flocks bore streaked young. So God has taken away your father's livestock and has given them to me. In breeding seasons, I once had a dream in which I looked up and saw that the male goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, or spotted. The angel of the Lord said to me, I'm sorry, the angel of God said to me in the dream, 'Jacob.' I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, or spotted, for I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land." And so amazingly here, Jacob, he gets to work immediately and being obedient to God. God said, time to go back. And Jacob gets Rachel and Leah together and starts organizing this trip back. And he maybe feels he has to convince them it's time to leave. Remember, this is the only home that they've ever known. They've been with Laban since birth there. And so he's got to convince them to leave, you know, to go out into the unknown, to go back to where Jacob is from. He's also got to teach them to trust in God, which he's just starting out himself in trusting and obeying God. But he's got to teach them now because they've grown up with what we'll see is a pagan religion. We'll see Laban has household gods. These are small g gods, false gods. And so he takes them out into the field. He takes Leah and Rachel out into the fields. This would be so they couldn't be overheard, so their plans couldn't be overheard by Laban or some of his servants or something like that. And just notice here, Laban is a flat character. Laban doesn't really grow at all. He's just pretty much wicked and deceptive throughout. But Jacob is not a flat character. Jacob grows. And we're going to see that even in this passage, that there's some growth in Jacob. Jacob has been a cheater, a deceiver, a scumbag up to this point, with some hints of some good things in Jacob. But now there's really a turn in Jacob. And so notice that when he's making his case to Rachel and Leah that it's time to go, he's saying that God, he says God is responsible for our success, for my success, for the success that I've had with the flocks. He says the God of my father has been with me there in verse 5. And he says that Laban has cheated him. And then in verse 6, he says, however, God has not allowed him to harm me. So he's acknowledging God as his provider and his protector. And now he's wanting to lead his family in obedience by going back to Isaac. This is a huge change for Jacob, right? This is not the Jacob we are used to. Jacob is giving credit to God, giving praise to God, acknowledging God. So now the question is, will Leah and Rachel and their families, all their sons, all the children, will they all go with Jacob? Verse 14. Then Rachel and Leah replied, "Do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? Does he not regard us as foreigners? Not only has he sold us, but he has used up what was paid for us. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to us and our children. So do whatever God has told you." So Rachel and Leah agree with Jacob. It's time to leave. And notice that they really don't have warm affection for their dad. They say that he sold us. He regards us as foreigners. They know that their dad, Laban, has not loved them well. They don't hold him in high regard. And so they're more than glad to get out from under his, you know, iron thumb, so to speak. They're not loyal to him. So remember before, Leah and Rachel had this rivalry between them about who's providing, you know, who's giving Jacob the most children and even using their maidservants. But they are united in this one thing, and that is their hatred for their father. And so they say, yeah, you know, all the wealth that God has given you, that should have been ours anyway. That should have been our inheritance anyway. And so they agree. And there's even maybe a hint of some faith in them, a blossoming faith in them. Do whatever God has told you. They want Jacob to be obedient. Let's go on to verse 17. Then Jacob put his children and his wives on camels, and he drove all his livestock ahead of him, along with all the goods he had accumulated in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. When Laban had gone to shear his sheep, Rachel stole her father's household gods. Moreover, Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him he was running away. So he fled with all he had, and crossing the river, he headed for the hill country of Gilead. So this would be traveling south. And so they run away. They wait till Laban and the other workers are busy shearing the sheep, and then they take off. And they take off with the whole family, all of the camels, all of the flocks, and they leave. The river that they cross would be the Euphrates River, so they're heading south toward Gilead, back toward Isaac. And you read here that Rachel steals Laban's gods. Rachel steals Laban's gods. Laban is referred to as Laban the Aramean, and it's not quite sure. Laban, these household gods would have probably been little statues that would have represented pagan false gods, pagan deities. They possibly could have included statues of ancestors. If you've heard of ancestor worship, sometimes they would make little statues of great-grandma or great-great-grandpa or whatever, and that they would kind of like pray to their great, you know, ancestors who have died and are in the afterlife. And these are false gods. And so it's not clear what Rachel's motivation is here in stealing these deities, these little statues. But it seems like at the very least, she's doing it out of spite for her father. She's doing it in a way that's disrespectful. She's taking something that's valuable to him. And so we see here again, just to stay on that theme of disintegration in the family, dysfunction in the family. Now there is this real split between Laban and his daughters. And so not only is Jacob's family dysfunctional with all these wives and children from different wives, but now the dysfunction, the disintegration in Laban's family is clear. They can't, Leah and Rachel, his own daughters, they can't wait to get away from him. Isn't that a horrifying thought to think of your daughters just, I can't wait to get away from dad and leaving, just never wanting to see him again, even stealing from him. I'm just going to summarize most of the rest of the chapter and then get into some application. We'll look at a couple more pieces of the passage here. But basically what happens next is that Laban finds out that Jacob and his daughters have taken off. And he chases them down. There's kind of this high-speed chase through the Middle East. And they end up close to Gilead. So he catches up to him eventually. And there's this, they come to a head. Laban and Jacob kind of face off now. What's going to happen? Laban is angry that Jacob has left with all of his family and some of the flocks. He says at one point in verse 26, this isn't on the screen, but in verse 26, he says, "What have you done? You've deceived me," which is almost word for word what Jacob had said to Laban when he had substituted Leah for Rachel on the wedding, on the day after the wedding. And so Laban gets a little taste of his own medicine and doesn't seem to have any good effect for Laban. He just doubles down. Laban is really a pretty despicable character. And so when he comes, it's actually like he's trying to start a fight. God actually tells Laban, don't say anything to Jacob, good or bad. Don't even speak to Jacob. But Laban does it anyway. And you can tell from Laban's words, he's almost wanting to upset Jacob, to provoke Jacob to start a fight. In other words, they almost come to like a war within the family. There's almost, you know, it almost comes to blows because Laban has, you know, in this chase, he's brought all of the relatives and they're ready to fight. And Laban is just acting so pious. He says, "Wow, why did you leave in secret? I would have given you a big celebration, a feast, and sent them off. I wanted to kiss my daughters and my grandchildren and send them off." Well, it's all, he's blown smoke. This is not true. Laban is acting pious, but he's just selfish all throughout. Eventually, Laban confronts Jacob about these stolen household gods and these statues, and Rachel, to hide them from her father, she sits on them in on the saddle of her camel. This is down in verse 34. So Rachel had sat on the household gods in the camel's saddle, and she comes up with an excuse of why she won't even get up. And I'll let you read that on your own, adults. So Rachel won't even get up. And this is just a humiliating thing. These pagan deities, it would just be a humiliating thing to be sat on by a woman in the situation that she describes there. I want to read to you. This will come up on the screen. Verse 38 through 42. This is what Jacob says. Finally, they're having this confrontation. And this is what Jacob says to Laban while they're having this. They're kind of facing off. He says, "I have been with you for 20 years now. Your sheep and goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten rams from your flocks. I did not bring you animals torn by wild beasts. I bore the loss myself, and you demanded payment from me for whatever was stolen by day or night." So he's just describing, "I've been a good worker for you. I was more than fair. This was my situation. The heat consumed me in the daytime and the cold at night, and sleep fled from my eyes. It was like this for the 20 years I was in your household. I worked for you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wages 10 times." And 10 times is probably just a round number. So just over and over again, you kept doing this. You were cheating. Now in verse 42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had not been with me, you would surely have sent me away empty-handed. But God has seen my hardship and the toil of my hands. And last night he rebuked you. Referring to Laban's hearing the message from God. So you can imagine Jacob, this years of frustration pent up, and now maybe he's practiced this speech and finally unloads on Laban. But notice that he doesn't enter into it he wants to fight. He wants to do battle. Instead, Jacob acknowledges God before Laban. He says, "The God of Abraham, the God of my father, has protected me." This title for God that he uses, he says, the fear of Isaac, can also be translated the awesome one of Isaac, the awesome one of Isaac. And so Jacob now is a public man of faith. He's publicly acknowledging before the whole family. Laban had brought all the relatives. Jacob is publicly a man of faith now. And so he's again acknowledging God and God's grace to him. Eventually, Laban, to finish out the chapter there, from verse 43 to the end of the chapter, Laban basically realizes he can't squeeze anything else out of Jacob. Jacob is left. Jacob is not going to stoop down to his level. And his family indeed wants to leave. Rachel and Leah don't want to be with him anymore. And so he basically says, well, let's make an agreement. Let's make a covenant and we'll part ways. Verse 44, he says, come now, let's make a covenant, you and I, and let it serve as a witness between us. And so they make a covenant the way that they made covenants in that time. They made a pile of stones and came to this agreement, basically saying Jacob and family will go that way and Laban and his family will go that way. And we're just going to permanently separate. We're going to permanently divorce, you know, from each other, and we just won't be involved anymore. And I would just say, how sad, how sad. It doesn't need to be like that, does it? They're family. They should be able to get along. And yet they do. They part ways, and it's permanent. When I get to some application here, we're obviously skipping over some portions of the passage there, but I want to get to some application. What does God want to do in us through the passage? And so I want to ask the question this way. Why did God have Moses record this account in Genesis? Why did God have Moses record this episode? The first thing would be just the obvious, that this is how it really happened. This is history. And remember, God, is through Moses, is giving the book of Genesis to the people of Israel as they're wandering in the wilderness. And they might have this curiosity, this interest in how did the nation of Israel come to be? How did it come to be the way it is? And so it's just a history lesson. But there's more to it than that. It's not just a history lesson. What else does God want to do in us through this? One thing I think is that Moses wants to show God's sovereign grace to Jacob and the founding of Israel as a nation. God's sovereign grace. In other words, when we talk about God's sovereignty, we're saying that God is somehow above and involved in what happens on the earth. He doesn't infringe on our freedom. We have genuine freedom. But God is somehow orchestrating. And sometimes he's getting directly involved, and sometimes it's imperceptible. We don't know exactly how he's involved, but in some way he's directing the free choices that we make to his desired ends. And one of the things that God wanted to do here is to bring about the nation of Israel that would be the family of the Messiah. And so God is orchestrating all of this to bring about the arrival of Jesus, the arrival of the Messiah. And so, again, behind all of this feuding between Laban and Jacob, they're feuding over their flocks, and Jacob's trying all kinds of crazy things to try to get his flocks to reproduce better and be stronger. Behind all of that is God. And God's arranging for certain animals to reproduce better so that Jacob ends up with bigger flocks. And so God provides for Jacob and the founding of this nation, the nation of Israel. Another thing that that Moses is wanting to do through this passage, and we'll spend a little more time on this, is to caution them about the constant danger of disintegration in the family. Moses is writing Genesis not to individuals only, but to families. To families. And so I think he wants to humble them. He wants to caution them. He's saying, look, the patriarchs, the heroes, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, as heroic, as much as you might exalt them, Israelites, they had their flaws. And you need to be cautious. If even they had to be on guard, if even they could make such big mistakes with their families, how much more ought you to be on guard? And so, again, we see this dysfunction in Laban's family. They're like running away from his daughters are running away from him. In Jacob's family, the dysfunction, the many wives, the children with the different wives. And so I want to just encourage us now to think about the possibility, the process of disintegration in our own families. There are particular sins that Laban and Jacob were guilty of that led to the disintegration of their own families. What sins of yours threaten your family? What is threatening to pull apart the relationships in your home? What influences, what sins in your own life are pulling apart at the seams your marriage, your relationship with your kids, your relationships between your kids, with each other? What dangers from outside threaten your family? We've seen highlighted for us in these passages Laban and Jacob's deception, their selfishness, Jacob's idolatry. Remember how he was looking for Rachel to fulfill him, this idolatry of romance and sex. What are the things that would tear apart your family? Are you aware of them? Are you aware that there is this constant danger, this constant threat? Satan would love to destroy your family and to destroy your marriage and for you guys to end up like Laban, for your home to end up like Laban's home. I'm just going to go through a list, and maybe you'll identify some of these. Yeah, that's a threat to my family. How about selfishness? Selfishness in marriage, selfishness in kids, selfishness among parents. It's all about my needs and my wants and my agenda. Are you taking but not giving? Are you not listening to your own family? Too busy with your own things? Are you pursuing one another in love? Husbands, are you pursuing your wives in love? Wives, are you responding and pursuing your husbands and romancing one another? Are you pursuing your kids? Or has your love grown cold, even in your own family? Is there a lack of grace and lack of charity among you? Do you assume the worst about each other? Do you blow up over small things? Do you hold grudges and get bitter? Do you have a critical spirit towards your spouse or towards your kids? Are you too busy? Have you thrown yourselves into so many things that family is just not even a priority now? Because I've got to do this, and I've got to do this, and I've got to do that. And they're all good things, but they're keeping you from having a flourishing, warm, love family. Is there marital unfaithfulness? Has the marriage grown cold? Is pornography wrecking your marriage? Parents, are you being overbearing? That one's one of mine. Are you being overbearing? Are you driving your kids away by staying so involved and maybe even manipulating? Or have you gone the other way? Have you checked out? Are you aloof? Are you always out in the garage or down in the basement or always at work or always on your phone or playing a game or whatever it is? And so your kids know that they're second. They're in second place to your work. They're in second place to your money. They're in second place to your hobby. Is TV a threat to your family? It's easy to think you're spending time as a family when you're by the TV, but you're not really spending time together, not in a meaningful way. Remember that quote I read for you last week or a couple weeks ago that said that in the average American family, that adults only have 15 minutes of quality conversation per week with their children. 15 minutes of quality conversation per week. What a shame. Is that a danger for you? Is that a danger that the TV's on or there's always something to do that's keeping you from really having that connection? Do you take one another for granted? Is there a reversal of leadership roles? Is dad letting mom just do whatever and he's sitting in the easy chair, letting mom take control? Dad's not even involved in discipline or training in righteousness. Is the speech in your home, is it edifying? Is it binding you together or is it driving you apart? Is there deception and lying? Is there name calling? Is there a lack of charity? Is there quick temperedness? Is there quarrelsomeness? Is there nagging? Is there jealousy? I think sometimes as parents, we just assume, just in our pride, we just assume, yes, we're doing a good job. We're doing a good job. Maybe there needs to be some humility. I know I need to improve. I'm not sure where it is, but I need to find out. I need to find out. Maybe you pulled away from the church family and you've pushed away people who would be involved and who would offer some loving challenge. We need each other to grow in this. Sometimes I need a brother or a sister to point out in my life. You're sowing some seeds now that are going to be painful for you later on. When you're cranky with your kids like that, or when you're overbearing with your kids like that, they're gonna resent you. They're gonna resent you. I need to have those kinds of challenges from a brother and sister in Christ. Moms and dads, maybe you allow there to be rivalries and conflicts between your kids, and you don't take the lead and deal with them. Do you let your kids tear each other apart, metaphorically? Do you let your kids have conflict and not get involved, and then things fester? It's like I have this goal or this dream, and I don't know that I've really thought about it a whole lot because our kids are still young. Kira's 11 now, so I guess I should have been thinking about it more. But it's like I want, hopefully, I don't know where my kids will grow, where all they'll go in life, what jobs they'll have, what cities they'll move to, if they'll be missionaries, who knows? But they could go all over the place. So I'm guessing that probably, they won't all live right down the street from me. But it would be my goal that I would have a good relationship with my kids when they're adults and that I would be able to have a good relationship with my grandkids someday. And again, even if they're spread out across the United States and in different parts of the world, I want it to be warm. I want them to look back and say, I love my dad and I can't wait to go home. I wish it was more often. We can't go all the time, but they want to be home and they want my advice and they want to spend time with me and they think fondly of their time growing up. And it's just easy to get in tunnel vision. Thinking that this phase is the only phase there will ever be. But no, of course they're going to get older. Of course there'll be adults eventually. And so what seeds am I sowing? What is this going to produce later on? Right now they're young and kind of easy to control, I guess. They don't really have a choice of where else they're going to go, but someday they're going to move out. And then there's going to be this choice. Parents of teenagers, I don't know if you're aware of that dynamic, that right now is this transition time. And as they're starting to move out more independent, they're starting to work, they have their own activities, and you're spending less time with them. And you used to cuddle on the couch, and now they're kind of too big for that, you think. And so there's not as much physical affection. And what is this relationship like now? And how is that going to be? Is it going to be what I want it to be 5, 10, 15 years from now? What a challenge. What a difficulty. It is interesting. There are several families that I've known over the years. Older Christian adults that have adult children now who are walking with the Lord and who love them, who look forward to spending time together. It's like, I want that. I don't want a family like Laban's. I don't want a family where they're, my kids hate each other and they're all resentful towards me and they don't want to spend time with me and I'm trying to use guilt trips to get them to come home and talk to me or anything like that. Do you want that? Do you want that relationship where there's just harmony and joy between husband and wife, and harmony and joy between parents and their kids, and even the kids, that they love each other. They'd be friends. That's something that Carol and I have prayed. We pray for regularly. We pray that our kids would be friends with each other, that they'd enjoy each other. How do we get there? What do we do? And I think, again, it's constant vigilance about these things. I gave you a long list. We can send them out an email if you want. But what are the things? What are the things that threaten the unity of my family? What are the things that are even now maybe are encroaching on the harmony in our family? Satan wants to break up your family. He wants to disintegrate. He wants to breed that resentment and the lying and all that. What are the threats to your family? Are you even aware of them? And so one thing I just want to encourage you to do if you're here with a spouse, that sometime today, maybe in the next couple of days, that you would just have an honest conversation. Maybe, if you get a list like this, what are the threats? And maybe you're already now even saying, I know what it is. It's the TV, or it's the deception, or we've been hiding things from each other. Maybe you know what it is automatically. But it'd be really helpful to just have a conversation with your spouse. And I asked that question in the beginning. Do you want God to work in your family? Are you willing to let God meddle? Do you really want to grow as a family in Christ? Have this conversation. What are the threats? Sit down, just the two of you. What are the threats? What are the things that are pulling? What am I doing, honey, that is harming our family? What are the things that I need to change by God's grace to bring greater unity and joy into our family? And I don't want you to just stop there, to have that conversation with your spouse, but then find somebody, maybe somebody in your life group, somebody the same gender as you, maybe somebody from your life group, just a close Christian friend, and say, hey, I had this conversation with my wife. Where are you at on this? What do you see in my family? What do you see in me? Do you see, are we too busy? Are we doing too many things? What's your perception of our family? Do you see things in our kids, disrespect? Do you see things in my marriage that you have concerns about, that someday this will lead to disintegration and harmony? Or maybe it's already happening now. I had this thought the other day. This is a tiring season for us. We've got 2 3-year-olds and a baby, okay? There's times where it's like, I just want to get past this phase and then it'll be better, right? And we won't have diapers anymore, and, you know, then everybody will be better behaved when they're a little older. So, it's like, I only have one shot at this phase. I only have one shot right now, this time in my life. This is the only chance I'll get. I don't want to rush past it. Instead, I want to be faithful in it. I want to be a steward of this season. It's challenge, you know, other seasons will have different challenges. Teenagers will bring their own challenges, right? Some people with teenagers would be like, yeah, that's even harder. I just want to be faithful with this season, with this stage, because I'll never have a chance. Guys, it's going to go so quick. People have warned us about that, you know, enjoy them now. It's going to go so quick. I already see it. Kira's 11. It's like, where did that go? Right? What can I do now in this season to be faithful, just to love my kids, to be faithful, to promote these flourishing relationships, this warm-hearted harmony, unity in the family? The thing that's encouraging here is that there is some growth in Jacob. There's some growth in Jacob. And this is the last thing there, to give them hope by showing the growth in Jacob. Jacob is not perfect, but here he begins. He starts acknowledging God and he starts leading his family. Now, some of the damage has already been done. You know, Jacob has made some mistakes that can't be put back together. Jacob still has flaws later on. He plays favoritism with Joseph and gets into all kinds of trouble. So there's already some damage that has been done. But if you're here and you look at your family and say, man, my family is kind of a mess. There are some things that do need to be addressed. There is hope for you. There is hope for you. And by God's grace, Jacob begins to grow. He starts moving in the right direction. Laban, it's pretty much a disaster. Don't be like Laban. Be like Jacob. Respond to God's grace and start moving in the right direction. yeah, you can't go back and put everything back together. You can't go back and undo the decisions and the parenting that you've had. You can't undo all that. So there might be still some damage left over. But right where you're at, God wants to give you grace. Grace for today. Grace for right now. To begin, at least. Jacob, he starts. He starts by acknowledging God as the provider and protector in his life. He starts obeying God. And so that's my encouragement to you. If you're here and you're like, yeah, I don't even know where to start. There is grace for you right now in this moment, in this situation, at this stage in your life. And God can begin to put some pieces back together and bring some good fruit. It's not going to be a perfect picture, but it can be a good picture. It can be a good picture. I was listening to Lee Strobel. Some of you will know that name. Lee Strobel is a Christian apologist, and he was an atheist. If you've seen the movie The Case for Christ, I would encourage you to watch that. He was an atheist and a pretty messed up one. He was an alcoholic, and he said that at one point in his career, he would come home from working at the newspaper, and his daughter would be playing in the living room, and she, as soon as she would see him come in the door, she would pick up her toys and go in her room and close the door. She was afraid of him. She didn't want to be around him because of his alcoholism and other things. She would leave him. Well, eventually, Lee Strobel, if you know the story, he ends up seeking out evidence for the Christian faith. He's trying to disprove his wife who'd become a Christian. But he eventually becomes convinced. And by God's grace, he comes to faith. He comes to faith in Christ. And the radical transformation that happens, the marriage that had been war, the relationship with his daughter that had been strained at best, she was afraid of him. God begins to put that back together. And so now they have a flourishing marriage. There's unity. There's integration instead of the disintegration. He's got a great relationship with his daughter and his other kids now. And I would just encourage you with that. There's grace for you. Don't hide. Don't say, my family is pretty normal. If there's work to be done, acknowledge it. Come out into the open. Get help. Sean and I, others, we'd be glad. Let's get on the right road. Let's get on the right path. Do you want God to come in and rehab and renovate your family? What an opportunity for our relationships. What an opportunity in our culture, dark culture as it is, so many families broken by divorce and all kinds of things. What an opportunity for us to shine out as beacons of light, beacons of hope. So just again, the questions I want to encourage you to deal with here in the rest of your day or in this coming week. What disintegration is there in my family right now? What is there now in seed form that will one day drive wedges between the relationships in our family? And how does God want me to respond right now? How, by God's grace, can I be like Jacob and just start? Just start acknowledging God, start being a man of prayer, start being a leader in my family. How can I respond to God's grace right now? So.